one more of gaiety than of solemnity. It is marked by festivities, by noise-making, parades, processions, and the clanging of the bells and the bang of the firecrackers goes back to man's concern that there might be evil spirits lurking in the way, ready to pounce on the new year, and so the noise is intended to drive them off. And the more psychiatrically oriented of our anthropologists tell us that the gaiety, the singing, the dancing, the festivities associated with the new year tends to be an unconscious act of defiance on our part. It's as if we were saying, I know that I have 1 year less to live, and I'm not going to let it get me down. Now, most peoples have marked the new year in some way. But it's interesting that only our people, the Jewish people, have turned the New Year's Day into a solemn high holiday, a Rosh Hashanah. Buddhism does not have a Rosh Hashanah, nor does Islam, nor does Christianity. These great religious traditions tend to celebrate annually the anniversary of major events in the lives of their founders. But the New Year's Day is a very minor moment in their calendar, if it's really marked at all. Only Judaism declares the New Year to be a great moment. Only we wholeheartedly celebrate the passage of time and the promise of time. And the reasons are not accidental. They go back to a unique stance in Judaism about this concept of time. Most traditions look on time as, at the very best, a quite mixed blessing. Indeed, most emphasize that it is a source of great suffering, sadness. After all, we all want to hold on to youth and strength and competence. None of us really wants to age, and certainly few of us want to die. And when life is good for us, when we're prosperous and secure, we want to hold on to this security and this prosperity. But as we well know, there is no day without its night, and no night without its day. And many of the pressures which pound in on us exist because of time. Time demands that we give up our leisure, give up the book that we're reading, give up our time with our family to go out and do what must be done. The farmer can't say when it's seed time or harvest, I don't feel like going to my fields today. I'll go at some other time. If he says that and acts on it, he will lose his fields. And though many of us, as we look at our children, would delight in their innocence, would like to protect them from growing up, from the buffeting and the heartaches which attend growth and life, they grow. It's inevitable. We can't escape from time. But it's interesting that we want to. Understandable, certainly. And when one looks at the great philosophies or religious traditions of our world, one discovers that almost unanimously they emphasize the passage of time, the instability that time introduces into life, and most of them tend to offer to their people some kind of teaching or gospel which suggests that one can, in fact, at some point, escape from time. Time is evil. Time is an enemy. And the ultimate good is to escape from this time-bound existence. And so Buddhism, for instance, tells its followers that if you follow its instructions and learn not to care about youth, age, maturity, competence, strength, all those things which are time-related, you will find happiness. Because then when you lose these things, you will not feel that you've lost anything. You'll have learned that they are, in fact, worthless. You'll have escaped from time. And Islam and Christianity both promise their followers that if they live by faith and do the right, then perhaps in the next life they will escape from time into the perfect peace of heaven. Now, only Judaism as far as I know, among the classic philosophies and religions, affirms the passage of time and confirms the promise of time. We are not to escape from time, but to enhance time. That's the essence of what Rosh Hashanah is all about. At the same time, or nearly at the same time, that Rabbi Akiba wrote the great lines of the Avinu Malkeinu hymn, which we recited today, these lines which affirm the possibility of the next year. Avinu Malkeinu, Chadesh Aleinu Shana Tova, our Father, our King, renew for us a good year, grant us a year of happiness. We look forward to the new year. One of the early fathers of the church was writing, blessed indeed is the man whose life is short. To the church, life was a via dolorosa, a way of trial, of tears, of tribulation. And to escape from life was the greatest of joys. And so when one dies, one celebrates awake, for that person has become awake to the greatness of the perfect peace of heaven. Now, our tradition did not attempt to blink away the suffering, the uncertainty, the buffetings which occur to every one of us as we pass through life. The psalmist is quite blunt on this score. The days of our years are 70 years, or even by reason of strength, some 80 years. Yet is their pride but travail and vanity. It is speedily gone, and we fly away. And one of the great writers of the wisdom literature in our Bible said this, rejoice, O young man, in your youth before the evil days come, when you shall say, I have little pleasure in them. Clearly, there is a time to be born, there is a time to die, and there is no gainsaying the fact of our frailty, of our time-bound existence, of our mortality. If you want to, however, understand the difference between our Jewish perspective and the traditional perspective of the other traditions, I would summon up to you the memory of the two great legends of judgment which lie at the base of Christianity and of Judaism. The Christian legend, folk legend, takes place once man has died. Presumably, each person presents themselves at the gates of heaven, and there Peter looks over their application form, and he decides if they are worthy of entrance into heaven, and if they do, they enter into a time when there is day but no night, pleasure but no pain, where time does not intrude. And as you know, at the very basis of Rosh Hashanah lies another legend of judgment, our own. It takes place not after death, but after each year. And the folk story has it that each of us at the end of each year stands in an open court before God. And there is a book in the court, a record of our deeds during the past year, and this record is read out, and a judgment is made. And if we pass the muster, our blessing is not death, but life. Our blessing is not to live briefly, but to live long, more of this time-bound existence. For the judgment that day is, mi yamutu mi yifyeh, who shall live and who shall die. Now, it's certainly possible that we might describe to ourselves and imagine to ourselves some scheme of things which would be more comfortable and more comforting to us, in which we would be forever young, in which we would be ever at the fullness of our competence and of our strength. But God, in his wisdom, has created to be otherwise. And Rosh Hashanah, which celebrates, among other things, creation, reminds us that in the creation story in our Bible, time is built into the very fabric of the universe. The world is created in time over a period of days, shaped over within time. Time somehow conforms to God's wisdom. God has seen fit to make us mortal. For if we were not mortal, where would be the place and the opportunity for our children and our grandchildren whom we love so much? We must die in order that others may live. Life has a necessary cycle. And God in his wisdom has imprinted this into the universe. And there is no purpose to be gained, no profit to be gained by complaining against it. And so Judaism, more than any other of the traditional religions and philosophies, has tried to teach us to accept, not to complain, not to rail against our fate, but to use the time which is ours, whatever, however long it be, as wisely, as lovingly, as sensitively as we possibly can. Now, in recent generations, many others have come to appreciate the promise of life, not for philosophic reasons so much, but because the world has become a gentler place. Because of medicine, we can now expect most of us, or at least we expect most of us, to live to be 80 years, or sometimes even to be 80 years of age, in relative good health. Childbirth is no longer something to be feared. And whereas most of our ancestors spent their lives doing back-breaking labor, we have escaped from that kind of work. And our work is of the mind, and there's much more leisure and opportunity and prosperity to our lives. And so it is that, particularly in the more prosperous parts of the world, men have tended to put behind them these old philosophies which take such a dismal view of life, and to look with greater optimism towards the future. But unfortunately, this optimism is not always coupled or married to wisdom. And so we find that as people look at the promise of existence, instead of trying to find that promise in the everyday, in the commonplace, in the intimate places of our lives, they think they can find it only on the weekend and not in the work week. All about us, there are those who have been taken in by the propaganda of the television and of the media, the advertisers, who want to sell us things that only by having, or more importantly, only by experiencing the thrills of leisure, the thrills of travel, the thrills of sport, only in that way can we find true happiness. We work in order to enjoy. Work is not seen as something which is capable of bringing satisfaction and the blessings of fulfillment. And that's a tragedy. For though clearly it's pleasurable to go skiing down a mountain, of course, unless we break our leg, and though it's probably a matter of some thrill, and I'm sure every nerve ending in our body vibrates if we go skydiving, I've never done it, but if we do, I'm sure that there's a sense of elation, of course, unless the parachute forgets to open. But what is equally true and often forgotten by those who look to the weekend and rather than to the everyday is that the greatest satisfactions of life come within the quiet of our homes, come within the intimate relationships at the center of our lives, come within the quiet moments which we spend with music, with art, with a good book. We don't have to travel. We don't have to have a thrill to live life with zest and with gusto, to enjoy the work that we do, if that work is innately satisfying. It's of service to others as well as to ourselves. If it engages our mind and our concerns and our compassion, it is not simply a way of earning our daily bread. Unfortunately, I'm afraid that many in our society have failed to look for satisfaction, for happiness, for the real pleasures that the new year can offer. And just as there are some who overemphasize leisure, there are others who overemphasize labor. You've heard them. There are those who tell you time is opportunity, don't waste it. Time is money, don't be a spendthrift. Keep your eye on the main chance, don't let anything divert you from your purpose. And now, of course, it's true. It's true beyond question that if we want to achieve something that's worthwhile, we have to be decisive, we have to be determined, we have to be active and committed, we have to persevere, that we better be sure that those things in which we're wasting our youth and our livelihood and our lives and our energy are worth the effort. We all know those who have sought so desperately for financial success or for fame or for social status that in the process they have lost their marriage and lost the love of their children and sometimes lost their health and their good name and the respect of their friends. There's an old English doggerel which I sometimes quote. It's worth reminding ourselves, being reminded of. He spent his health to get his wealth, and then with might and main he spent his health to get his wealth again. And the Hasidim tell a story of their great Rebbe, Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. Levi Yitzchak was walking one day in the streets of Berdichev, and he saw one of the more affluent members of the town racing through the town, elbowing people aside, heedless of anyone else except wherever he was headed. And he stopped the man and he said to him, "Good sir, where are you running to?" And the man said, "I have to run. Time is money. I'm running after my livelihood." And Levi Yitzchak said to him, "Kind sir, how do you know that your livelihood is out there ahead of you? Perhaps it's behind you, waiting to catch up with you." And very often, we find those who have raced to make their livelihood and have made it, who find that when they face retirement or some other moment, their livelihood is really behind them. It was left at all those moments in life, those decisive moments when they chose not to sustain the ties of love and of intimacy within the home, not to develop new talents and new interests, not to care about their good name or what others felt of them, not to care about the well-being of the community, but only to care about amassing, about winning, about the one goal that they had set for themselves. Now, inevitably on a New Year's Day such as this, each of us thinks back over the year and there's a bit of sadness. For all of us at times have been, have procrastinated, have said there'll yet be time. And sometimes there is no time. We remind ourselves on a day such as this of the importance of the third term of Hillel's famous saying, you know it well, "If I'm not for myself, who will be for me? If I'm for myself alone, what am I? If not now, when? Im lo achshav ematai." It's sad when we have to say it's too late. Recently, I had a young woman come into my office. She had left home some years before, bitter adolescent anger against her parents. The years had seasoned her and saddened her and made her wiser, and she'd come back for reconciliation. But her father had died, and her mother was no longer responsive. It was too late. She broke down. For many of us, it becomes too late when we put off. We say, there'll yet be time to follow my other interests. There'll yet be time to speak the words of love that I ought to speak. There'll yet be time to offer myself in service to my community. And often when that time finally comes, we lack the strength or we lack the skills or they want younger people. It's important to do what needs to be done now. But it's equally important to be sure that what we do is worth the effort. Rosh Hashanah, in many ways, captures and refracts the ancient wisdom which our people have always tried to enunciate as far as time is concerned. And we do so through the shofar. The shofar is for us what the church bells were for medieval Europe. It's our instrument through which we announce time. In ancient Israel, there were, of course, no calendars. In ancient Israel, when a new moon was to be announced, the people would look into the skies until they saw the new moon, which was the indication of a new month. And then the shofar would be sounded that all might know that the new month had begun. And over the years, as I've listened to the shofar, I found that each of its four calls, the tekiah, that shrill, unexpected sharp call with which the shofar service begins, the shvarim, that rather energetic burst of sound which keeps repeating itself, the Torah, the rather quavering, lower-keyed sound, and then the tekiah gedolah, that sound which requires every bit of sustained breath, which the Baal tekiah has, that piercing, long, sustained sound. But these four sounds, in many ways, speak to me of four of the basic teachings, the basic understandings which our people have developed, which are useful in understanding our time-bound existence. When I first hear the tekiah, I'm always surprised, for I forget from year to year, the shrillness, the sharpness, the suddenness of the sound. And I find it saying to me, a year has passed, put it behind you. Don't try to act as if the year is not over. It is. Increasingly among us, we have come to understand that growth and learning ought not to be limited to our youth, to the times when we're in school. And it's part of the conventional psychological wisdom of our day that at every stage of our lives, we ought to continue expanding our horizons, exploring new avenues of activity, developing new talents, some of the other talents which are within us. Our lives shouldn't be narrow. They should continue to be expansive and expanding. And of course, there's truth to this. But I'm afraid that there are many of us who have felt that somehow, despite the years, we can continue to act, to react as if we were in our 20s and 30s, at the peak of our physical and emotional powers. We don't like, as a generation, to think that we are growing older. Now, we know that it's rather laughable when a person of 70 tries to speak with the jargon and dress in the modish ways of those who are 20 or 25. But I'm afraid that many of us have deluded ourselves that when we're 40 or 50 or 60 or 70, we're still really 20 or 30. Yes, we know that our body has aged, although we try to find a variety of ways even to deny that. But more importantly, few of us recognize that we have aged psychologically. We have aged emotionally, and that aging process is as irreversible as is the physical aging process. Youth is a time of passionate interest, passionate commitments, fresh eyes. When we're young, we believe that there is nothing we cannot accomplish, that there is no cause which cannot be completed and consummated. We don't admit to the cautions, to the prudent advice which our parents and and the larger world puts before us. And the world has need for the vision of the youth. But when one has been buffeted by life, and inevitably as we grow older we are, when we are more experienced, when we have lived through almost every possible experience one way or another, it's impossible any longer to look at life continually with the same eyes that are the same fresh eyes. It's impossible to react in the same way without the cautions that experience has bred into us. It's impossible to believe any longer that the commitments which are ours, because we believe them firmly and because we know them to be right, will somehow inevitably win out in the end. We've seen too often that the best laid plans of mice and men off Gangagee. Youth is for the young. Middle age is for the middle-aged, and age is for the aged. And the world has the need of the balance, the interplay which occurs between all of these. Many have remarked on what has become an epidemic among us, a new disease. It's called the middle-age crisis. And what is this disease? It's the unwillingness or the inability of someone in their middle years, however one defines that, to accept the fact that they are in their middle years. They think they can still react with the strong emotional freshness of their youth. They're puzzled that their relationships with others are now gentler. They're puzzled that they don't have the same deep reactions to things they once had. They want to recapture those feelings. And so they throw off the garbs of middle age. They throw off many of the relationships which they have developed over time, thinking that they can somehow simplify life and find life and find again the wonderful feelings of optimism, of certainty, which surrounded them when they were young. And they cannot. We cannot. But so many feel that this is possible in our society because there is very little in our culture which reminds us as we're growing older that in fact the inner world, the inner spirit is growing also. Everything that we see in the television, the media says to us, you can stay young. Be young of heart. Be young of spirit. Be young of spirit. But young for your years, not young in an absolute sense. That's the tekiah sound, to accept the passage of time, not to try to turn back the inner clock. Your children, your grandchildren, need your maturity, not your youth. Our world needs their passion and their energies, but the world also needs the experience and the sense of stability and standards which comes with time. And then there is a shivarim, the repetitive staccato feeling, the energetic sound, which always reminds me of a troop at double speed with the little steps it's taking, moving forward in a kind of energetic pattern. The shivarim says to me, there are years which you waste, and years should not be wasted. A year is a fixed measure of time, but there are some who fill each year, or will fill this particular year, with great achievement, who will use it to the full. And there are others who will fold their hands and let the year flow over them. The Talmud puts it this way, Yesh shanim sheyesh lechem chayim. There are years which have life. V'yesh shanim she'ein lachem chayim. And there are years which have no life. Now the difference is not in the year. The difference is in us. The difference is in our commitment. In the energy which we rouse within ourselves. And the spirit which we bring to life. It's really tragic when someone folds their hands in a sense, gives up. Fill the year with energy. Use it to the full. You'll be surprised how many opportunities are there. But as I said earlier, it's unwise simply to run ahead without thought towards the goals which we are towards which we are running. And so we have the trua, the other middle call, a quavering, rather low-pitched call, which says to me always, be careful. Think before you leap. Be intelligent and judicious about what you do. The word intelligence is an interesting one. It comes from two Latin terms, inter, between, legere, a root which means to choose. Intelligence is the capacity to choose between alternatives, to choose what is worthwhile, to discard what is worthless. To choose among the many challenges, the many calls on us, the many duties and responsibilities which we might undertake, and to choose carefully and judiciously and wisely. And life certainly requires that kind of choosing, that kind of intelligence. Look before you leap. Be energetic, but be sure that your energies are usefully directed to your benefit, and to social benefit, to the benefit of those who surround you and who share this world with you. And finally, singly, at the end of the shofar service, the great tekiah gedolah, that great sustained aspiring call, which says to me, yes, life is bruising. Yes, there are many defeats. Yes, there will inevitably be times of great frustration. Life requires steadiness, perseverance, steadfastness. There is nothing more tragic than the person who sets out to accomplish something worthy of them, but who turns back and surrenders at the first defeat. Nothing is achieved easily. Everything has a cost. In life, we must be steady, certain of our purpose. Perseverance is an ultimate virtue. And what can strengthen us along the way besides our own resolve and will? At the end of the long Tekiya Gedola, I always hear an echo. I know that basically it's nothing more than that the Baal Tekiya has run out of breath. But there's a sudden intake, as if the sound is coming back. And somehow that little echo at the end of the Tekiya Gedola says to me, have faith. You're not alone in this universe. God is here with you. God will establish ultimately the work of your concerns and the work of your hands. For ultimately, this great affirmation of time, which lies at the basis, the very basic basis and foundation of our religious tradition, rests on a certain faith. It rests on a faith in God who is not unaware of our concerns, who is not indifferent to our fate, who did not place us in life as to sadistic playthings whose antics he can watch, but who gave us life sufficient to our needs in a world created according to his wisdom, a God who will be a partner with us in the establishment of peace and justice, of family, of all that will make for the happiness of life on earth, if only we persevere. There is a return. There is a strengthening from without, even as we seek to strengthen ourselves from within. And if I were to sum up, as I do now, all that I've been trying to say, it is simply this. There's a phrase in our tradition, Ashrei ha'ish ha'sameach b'chelko. Happiness consists in finding satisfaction in your lot. Our lot is to be human, not immortal. Our lot is to live on this time-bound earth, in a time-bound existence, not to live in some timeless world where change does not intrude. Our lot is to have a finite number of years in which to work out our hopes and our destiny. It is not to have an endless supply of time. But we can be satisfied with our lot. There are hopes that do come true. There are moments of great joy. We've all known them. There are moments of fulfillment and satisfaction as we look back upon a life where time has been well spent. And the question which we ask ourselves always, am I doing what ought to be done, what needs to be done, is the question of Rosh Hashanah. And the answer that we give will determine the sense of fulfillment that we will have, both in the living and in the remembering. So be happy in your lot. Be happy to be human and make the most of that possibility. Amen.